Vítejte u Co je slyšet a co není slyšet, podcastu Liberálního institutu. Já jsem Martin Pánek a dneska vás zvu na díl, kde si budeme povídat s profesorkou Charlottou Stern, profesorkou sociologie na Stockholmské univerzitě a ředitelkou švédského think tanku Ratio. Nejdřív zazní její přednáška o klasické liberální sociologii a potom následuje debata se studenty a dalšími diváky. Takže věřím, že si to užijete a předávám slovo.
I want to talk about sociology and classical liberalism, I guess. And first, I have two notes. And although I speak of sociology, I think that the situation that I'm talking about sort of generalizes across most of the social sciences and humanities, perhaps with that outside of policy and economics. I mean, there's basically no classical liberal traditions to speak of. And, you know, these disciplinary boundaries, of course, should just be ignored in general. I'm very much with Brian Kaplan on these matters, and he often says, just go ahead and do what you think is fun, and then you call it economics. And so, you know, like, I can just say, like, okay, I'm gonna do stuff and call it sociology. You could think that it is because of that the sociologists of the world are non-ideological, that they're scientistic, and hence they don't really believe in ideology being tainted in their discipline. But if you think about it and you know anything about sociology, you know that there are plenty of Marxist sociology, critical theory, public sociology, and such themes that are very closely aligned with what you would think of as Marxist or socialist thinking. So, you know, that is certainly not why there's no liberal tradition in sociology. And I'm going to talk about liberal, by the way, although it might be better in a US audience anyway. So can I say that there is no such thing as a classical liberal sociologist? And you cannot make this out now, but what it actually means is that I Googled classical liberal sociology. I got one hit, and it's a paper with Dan that I had written myself. But this, in 2013, there was one hit. So, you know, now it's 2023, so I did it again. And now we have three hits. So there's an increase in interest of classical liberal sociology. However, I noticed that there's also some kind of backlash because the third hit is liberty's hollow triumph. So there seems to be perhaps not that genuinely friendly take on this topic. So, you know, it's dead, basically. And just to sort of prove that this is not true with Marxist sociology, I did a hit on that too and got over, I don't know, 3,000 hits and 8,000 in 2023. So, you know, there's no veining of a Marxist sociology or interest in that. I also did a libertarian sociology because I was thinking that, you know, the US, plenty, many people, and they call themselves libertarian. And I think I got 11 hits. So good news. If you really want to be a classical liberal sociologist, you only have to read about 15 articles and be like the world expert on this topic. So I think I'm going to spend the summer actually doing that, and then I can tell you all there is to say about classical liberal sociology. Anyway, let me start by saying that you could sort of think that there were liberal thinkers that were proto-sociologists. And I want to mention just Adam Smith and de Tocqueville, because these are actually people I've read, and I think that they're pretty amazing. I think they are very, very good liberal scholars and liberal thinkers. And what they do that I think is admirable is that they talk a lot about how individuals are situated in social context. So they have a very sort of sociological take on the world. So even though they're individualist thinkers and believe in liberal principles, They have a very sociological understanding of the world. We care about others, we take others' perspective into account when we judge things and do things. And so, you know, even before sociology, there were like sociological liberal thinkers. One of the favorites of mine is actually Smithian social distance theory of sympathy. That I think is great in the sense that it transcends sort of the rational choice and communitarian sort of dichotomies. I don't know if you're rational choicers, but you know, just the idea that you're self-interested and pursue your own interest, and how that somehow would then conflict with a more kind of social individualism, caring about others and taking others' interest into account. And I think Smith sort of just brilliantly sort makes the case for it's not either or, it's actually just part of the same kind of process. And of course you care for yourself most, and then you care for your neighbors and your family and so on, but you also do care about humanity and the world at large, and you should. I mean, that's what a good person does. And I think that is very powerful for me, and I think that is how I think about how the world actually works. There were actually classical liberal sociology once upon a time. Some of the earliest thinkers like Herbert Spencer, Harriet Martineau, Sumner, that I'm now blanking his first name, William Graham Sumner. They were very much sort of laissez-faire sociologists. They did not have a great following, but you know, Herbert Spencer had very interesting sociological ideas about evolution, ideas of progress, stages of societal development, where he thought that, you know, society moved through different parts and how we started in sort of military society, where hierarchy, obedience, discipline, and simple and undifferentiated society was the norm. And we went into the industrial society, which was voluntary, contractual, complex, and differentiated. These notions are very familiar to students of sociology, but we attribute them to Emile Durkheim. He's seen as one of the founding fathers of sociology. It turns out that there's a whole literature, once you start digging into this, that discusses how Durkheim wrote The Division of Labor in Society as a critique of Spencer. But when you study the ideas that Durkheim is sort of promoting in Division of Labor, you know, the overlap with Spencer's thinking is about 75%. They are very alike. And so he basically takes Spencer's ideas and says, oh, don't read Spencer, I'm much better. And so, you know, he won the battle. So no one reads Spencer anymore. Although there's great sociological intuition in Spencer. And Stephen Davies wrote about Spencer's Law in 2001, which is a brilliant sociological analysis, I think. And he says that Spencer noted that there is a degree of public concern and anxiety about a social problem or phenomenon that varies inversely as to its real or actual incidence. And so in societies, as things are getting very much better with regard to alcohol, education, poverty, the status and treatment of women in society, we become extremely intolerant and start screaming for state action to abolish the last sort of drop of social issues. I think that is an idea that is completely forgotten in sociology and that we should revive. And it would be like a very interesting empirical case to actually follow these kind of social movements and how they're sort of changing over time from sort of mobilizing themselves into screaming for you know, state enforcement. I see this myself in when I've studied Swedish folk movements, where they start off as like self-help organizations, like the temperance movements, and then over time they become, you know, political and push for political prohibition of alcohol and those kinds of things. So it's a very interesting sociological idea. Harriet Martineau is considered one of the first sociological method thinkers. She wrote on how to observe manners and morals, very much a very modern take on morals, because she said, like, you cannot judge morals of others from your own perspective. You have to understand the context in which they are, you know, coming out. And so, you know, she sort of said, you have to observe locals on their own terms, and you can't be too judgmental in sort of, you know, having your own norms in that. She wrote also about society in America. Basically, she was an extraordinary woman of the time. She was a successful author, and she contributed to society and sociology, but she's very much not really a star in the field. She wrote about the factory controversy, a warning against meddling legislation, where she sort of spells out a classic case against government regulation as a threat to the rule of law and a source of arbitrary power, etc. So she's a good sort of classical liberal sociologist, speaking about stuff that sociologists care about, morals, norms, the way we sort of organize our social fabric of society, but she was a liberal. And the same goes for Sumner. He's mostly famous in the US, but he also wrote on manners and customs and was a very strong sort of laissez-faire kind of guy. Now I'm gonna go through this quicker. So, you know, what happened with these people is that, you know, they are very seldom covered in traditional sociological textbooks. So there's a basic neglect of this tradition overall in sociology. And there's sort of this scientism that kind of pretend that ideas, especially liberal ideas, doesn't matter. So, you know, you become a very kind of empirical sociologist or just like a theoretical sociologist, and so you know, ideology doesn't play a role. And if classical liberal ideas are presented in textbook, it is often in this kind of shape that I sort of illustrate here, where it sort of starts like, oh, once upon a time there was a tradition of the Scottish Enlightenment. They had classical liberal ideas. And then came socialism and socialist ideas, and they took over. And then came social democracy, and then we lived happily ever after. Sort of like a progressive kind of idea that, you know, like, oh, that was relevant then, and now it's this social democratic kind of lifestyle and ideas are what's really important. And so, you know, as if classical liberal ideas are sort of out of fashion or have become non-important to the world. Max Weber, of course, is one of the most famous sociologists in the world, I think. He's often together with Durkheim and Marx considered like the troika of the founding fathers of sociology. He was a self-described liberal, but of course no one talks about him being a liberal when they're presenting his idea in sociology textbooks. And he was a part of the historical school of economics and very much emphasized how economic life occurs within the historical context of the time. He also was big on hermeneutics, the Verstehen tradition, basically saying, like, if you really want to understand society and social order, you need to understand what people are thinking and you know, what's underlying their behavior. So far, very, very far from sort of a rational choice kind of like thinker that is so famous in economics. And of course, the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism is a very significant contribution to classical liberalism, I think. And it is also often understood to be an implicit critique of Marxism. Because of the way he sort of argues for the importance of ideas in bringing about social change. I mean, for those of us who have studied Marx, we know that he's a historical materialist. So he thinks that, you know, the means of production is what sort of creates social change. And all, you know, Weber is doing in the Protestant ethic is saying, like, no, actually, it was these ideas of individualism, of predestination that made capitalism happen. Of course, we can debate whether or not that is empirically true, But it's a very important idea. I mean, it's an idea that says, like, you know, what people think actually matters, and not just sort of the way their material life is upon them. So why did the tradition disappear? Well, it didn't completely disappear, because there are some kind of sociological thinkers that are either conservative-leaning or sort of liberal-leaning. Edward Shields, Hans Zetterberg, which is a famous, world-famous in Sweden, and then, of course, Peter Berger, who is also one of the greatest sociologists in modern era. I mean, he wrote The Social Construction of Reality, which is a fantastic book. If you haven't read that, read it. He also wrote a book called Invitation to Sociology in the 60s, which is very good too if you're interested in sociological ideas. However, he also wrote a disinvitation to sociology, published later in life, where he says, like, this field has gotten so normative, so left-leaning, it's not, you know, like, it's doomed. Don't even go there. So, you know, he kind of went from celebrating sociology as one of the most wonderful social sciences to, like, oh my God, you know, people, stay away. But, you know, he was a good guy. And so what happened? Well, the Spencer-Sumner tradition became smeared as social Darwinism. So the evolutionary thinking of these early sociologists who were classical liberal sort of became attacked as social Darwinism. And in particular, it's Richard Hofstadter who is sort of bringing the knife to these guys. And as often happens is that when someone is very successful in smearing another person or another tradition, people stop reading the original texts and then just kind of takes for granted that Hofstadter, what he's writing is true. And so that is what happens with these guys. And so no one really reads Spencer and Sumner in sociology anymore. And this whole social Darwinism is kind of like in any textbook you read, you will see that, oh, Spencer is also a social Darwinist. Of course, these guys never call themselves social Darwinists, so it's like a construction by Hofstadter himself. And really what is going on, and that there's a debate here too, if you start looking into it, is that Hofstadter hated laissez-faire. And so he was really, really angry at Spencer and Sumner for sort of advocating those kinds of ideas, and found the sort of the perfect way to kill it, sort of. Of course, then the 1960s and 70s happened, and this is this is sort of the highlight of sociology in the Western world. This is when sociology departments expanded and grew and became very important, and it sort of co-occur with a generation that disliked Western civilization. So it became all about class, power, race, and gender. And, you know, C. Wright Mills critiqued consensus theory. Markets are consensus theories because they say, oh, people can work together and actually, like, produce harmonious social relations. So, you know, this is when sociology became all about conflict theory and sort of went Marxist. And this is also, of course, when Marx became a sociologist and added sort of to the classic list. And does it really matter? Well, you can sort of say that, you know, if the field of sociology dies out or if is left, it doesn't really matter. But if you are a classical liberal sociologist and you sort of think that ideas of liberty is important, you want to sort of feel like there's a place for you in your own discipline, of course. And, you know, you then want to say that these are actually worthy ideas to explore also in social sociologists. So when I think about classical liberal sociology, there isn't much that you can follow in the path of, right? But there's some traces, and we could think of that part of the classical liberal tradition in sociology as being very focused on evolutionary thinking. The idea that societies are actually progressing in processes forward. Just like sort of liberal society as understood by Smith, Spencer, and Hayek, which would bring with it sort of also this notion that it is an unnatural context for humankind. We have these sort of collectivist instincts and sentiments, you know, the atavistic impulse that Hayek writes about. So, you know, all is one is, as enforced by the state, sort of is part of the human genome, if you want. And so it's hard for us to understand. And that also means that it is really important to preserve these ideas, because if you don't teach them to our students, they won't get it, sort of. We also have Edward Shields' civility concept that I really like and appreciate. Shields wrote of civility as something to be nurtured. So civility means the developed skill of the free to be free, the necessary virtue to sustain liberty. And if you don't have civility in society, if you're not good-mannered between persons, and if you don't take responsibility and concern yourself with public affairs, the common good, so to speak, you do not, you know, liberal societies cannot survive. And so we need sort of to foster this kind of civility in our societies. And of course, Smithian sympathy, of course. So it is an individualistic sociology, I think, that I would sort of want to proclaim as part of the classical liberal tradition, but it is not really a rational choice or sort of public choice or whatever you want to call it, individualism. So it's more along the lines of the individualism that Tocqueville describes in his travels from America, an enlightened individualism, so to speak. Where you care for others, but you're also very good at sort of being a good source in society, a prospering civil society, helping neighbors, sort of being a good sport, if you want. So virtues, tradition, culture, you know, encourage classical liberals in the further study of virtues, of mores and folkways. I think that in general, we have a neglect in studying these kinds of social norms, if you want. And we should be more curious about both to study them, to build them, and what happens when they disappear. So in sort of helping sociology to also contribute to sort of classical liberalism, which is very much part of an economic tradition, I think that sociology could bring this kind of theorizing, and that would be good. So you could think of it as being part of a motion towards a warmer type of liberalism, where you sort of say like, well, you know, it's not only about maximizing utility actions, it's also about, you know, caring for others, the responsibilities to the whole, etc. And bringing that in, I think, would benefit classical liberalism in the sense that I think that more women would be attracted to the idea. I noticed that I am the only one here, for instance, and that is often the case. It is obvious that classical liberal ideas have a more of an appeal to men. And these relevance of ideas of freedom would then also be more relevant outside of just markets and economies. And I think that would greatly actually benefit society as a whole. So, you know, I often meet this kind of attitude among my students towards free markets. They think that free markets is all about efficiency, competition, growth, innovation, productivity, and they don't find that meaningful. They are like, well, you know, I care about other stuff. You know, I want to have a good life. I want to find love and meaning. And so, you know, if we were to expand classical liberalism to sort of encompass also a defense of like honesty, promise keeping, collaboration, and community, maybe more people would see the light. And that, I think, is everything I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you for the talk. I really liked it. And I actually have a question which might not be like 100% related to your talk, but that's something which bothered me for a long time. And when I read Hayek's Contra-Revolution of Science, he basically told me, like, sociology, that's a dark place, never go there, like from Lion King. And I never did, and I really appreciate what you have to say, but I would like to hear you, like, hear if, like, if you have any position on what Hayek wrote about sociology and Contra-Revolution of Science, or, like, his views and critique of it.
I'm sure he was perfectly right. I mean, there are so much capitalism bashing in sociology. There's so much emphasis on sort of the downsides that, you know, we and now I'm talking about we as in the sociology discipline. We actually sort of get students who think that the world is going, you know, we're getting worse over time, which is, of course, empirically not true. But there's so much emphasis on discrimination, on gender pay gaps, on all these kinds of social issues that are, you know, like appealing to certain types of people. And so I'm sure that Hayek was right in saying, like, if you want to be sane and happy, don't go into sociology, unfortunately. You know, I in an earlier version of my presentation, I had, you know, like, let's start positive sociology. That would be then a way of like turning that around and sort of saying, like, let's focus on all the good things that humans do. You know, like, we're actually good at collaborating. We're actually good at sort of getting things done together. And, you know, there's just no appreciation of that. It's kind of all not so happy invoking.
How many questions can I have? I have like five, so. So thanks a lot for your talk. That's the first thing. And maybe I would like to ask first about the social Darwinism stuff. I mean, you mentioned, I mean, Hofstadters, I guess, and I'm almost sure that I already heard that name in a paper about Hayek. It was, I mean, I found it here. It was like by Sandra J. Peart or Peart, I don't know, and David Levy, Hayek and Individualists. And I think they say there that Hayek actually was agreeing with this line of argumentation against social Darwinism, and that he was very engaged in this battle, and he really tried like to purge the movement of these guys, because I don't mean Spencer, but some other guys whose names I don't remember because they are now irrelevant because Hayek like kicked them off, and they were actual racist, or at least that they said stuff like slavery was actually okay because stuff. And so I wanted to ask if you think that really all of this stuff by Hofstadter was just a smear campaign, or if there was actually something that was relevant. And
I think that when it comes to Spencer and Sumner, he sort of attributed social Darwinism to them, without them ever sort of being part of the social Darwinist movement. So I'm sure that there were horrible people. I mean, the whole eugenics movement and all that kind of stuff that also happened, which was mostly part of a progressive thing. I mean, it wasn't like classical liberals were like, oh yeah, let's violate people's bodies by, you know, forcing them to castration or whatever. So I think that what the literature that is discussing Hofstadter's smear campaign is focusing on is it actually true that they are presenting these ideas in their texts? And I think that what they're showing is that no, they are actually not saying the stuff that he says that they're saying. So it's a little bit like fact-checking. So, you know, he's saying, oh, Sumner and Spencer were social Darwinists, and when people go back and look, they say, no, you know, there's actually nothing in here that speaks to that. So he's sort of doing a little bit of quoting here and there without, out of context, and, you know, there's a whole debate on this. So, you know, it's not like social Darwinism is a particularly good idea. So that was my response.
You mentioned that there is a lot of like capitalism bashing in the social science circles. I wanted to ask, is it really an issue in like the high profile sociology journals, or is it more like the people are themselves like anti-capitalists? Because my impression as a bystander, I feel like at least in Czech Republic, when I observe the sociologists, they are more like technocratic center guys doing just very, very empirical things. Even and it's like related. Second question, maybe that my impression is that they even resigned to any attempts to make any theories. Even more than economics, they really just care about like, yeah, here is a hypothesis, let's do an experiment, here are the data, conclusion, and that's it. And what I want to ask, like, overall is, like, does it really matter that there is a lot of, like, Marxism going around when the science actually looks like this? Maybe it doesn't really matter that much, no?
Sociologists on strike, nation in peril. No, I agree with that. I mean, there's a lot of just plain simple empirical sociology that is mostly harmless. You could argue that portraying the labor market as highly discriminatory towards women and immigrants and so on is sort of putting into question whether or not a market-based system works, right? Market failures are everywhere because we have all these, you know, studies that show like, oh, there's a 4% wage gap between men and women, hence, you know, employers are evil. And so, you know, there's something to be said for even that, even if it's just like, look here, there's a discrepancy in the mean. But I think that what is more problematic is actually like the teaching and the classroom. I mean, so, you know, when you move into the classroom and what is said there about globalization or just Western societies or capitalism or whatever you want to kind of talk about, I think that is a problem. And then there, of course, there are outside of sort of the more quantitative statistical sociology, there's a whole field of qualitative studies, which is really. another ball game. And those they exist too, you know, and they're actually quite a big part of you know, and there you have the whole kind of woke tradition and, you know, anti-colonialism, whatever you want to call it.
My second question of my five questions. Maybe I also would like to ask one. Yeah, it's again about Spencer, but it's completely unrelated to the other question. You mentioned that, like, Durkheim actually ripped off Spencer a lot. And Durkheim and also all these other guys like Weber and, I mean, also Berger are actually pretty famous here at the university in the field of study of religion, where there is this field of sociology of religion, and I just there is a lot of talk about this Protestantism ethic stuff, and then also Berger, and also Durkheim and his like notion of like social function of religion. So maybe I wanted to ask if maybe Spencer had something to say about it, or maybe if it was actually his idea, and I don't know, maybe Durkheim also stole it from him, or
I don't really think so. I think it's division of labor in society I think it was Durkheim's dissertation, and then he moved into all these other more religion and stuff like that. So I'm not sure that, I don't know if Spencer wrote on religion. I have a feeling that he was not particularly religious, just from personality, but I don't know. But it's great. Sociology of religion is a fun field.
So
and it's actually, yeah.
He didn't steal from him.
No, I don't think that he did. Yeah. Well, he might have stolen. No, I don't think that he intentionally stole. I think that he really, if you want to do a nice interpretation, is that he actually found Spencer, really appealing, but he didn't like the laissez-faire part. And so he wanted to take the evolutionary stuff and then say, like, because in Division of Labor, what he's doing is that he's saying that, contracts without social context doesn't work. Contracts without sort of this relations and trust and norms of cooperation is just a piece of paper that means nothing, right? And so you have to have the social first, and then you can have the contract, so to speak. And so, he kind of wanted to make market interaction more sociological, if you want. And so he did that, and in the process kind of also reinvented Spencer's evolutionary theory, or something along those lines. I kind of like Durkheim, so I don't really want to bash him.
I was actually exaggerating. I have just three questions, so this is my last one. I also would like to ask about other thing you. Excuse me.
I have a question
about Spencer. About whom?
Spencer.
Who is it?
Who's Spencer?
So I would be remiss not to ask the question. If you have any thoughts on the appearance of Herbert Spencer's name in the dissent in Lochner v. New York at the U.S. Supreme Court, where Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. wrote that, the Constitution of the United States does not enable Herbert Spencer's theories.
I wasn't aware of that.
No?
No.
Okay. I'm sorry. So to make long story short, Lochner v. New York is a case about limited labor hours in New York, and the court struck the state legislation down, and which now, of course, this case today is one of the most infamous cases, because how dare the Supreme Court strike down a state law limiting, labor hours. But the majority back then struck it down, but Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. dissented, and he named Herbert Spencer as the culprit or whatever.
Of the cruel world of long work hours and child labor, yes. Etc. Yeah, no, I think that is probably part of the sort of laissez-faire simplification and Darwinism. I don't really know if he had read Spencer, or if he was just kind of going on the reputation.
Okay, it's me again. I'm the problem, it's me. Taylor Swift. My last question is the worst one. It was from the best to the worst. You also mentioned more times that contemporary sociology is focused also on stuff like gender and also some other stuff. But I would think that this is actually pretty relevant stuff, and not only gender, but also other issues like, I don't know, gay rights, LGBT rights, I don't know. Many stuff that is not like economic. So I was actually curious if you think that in this classical liberal sociology there is a place also for these issues, if it has something to say about it, if it's maybe something fresh, something new, or maybe some new perspective, or something like that. Thanks.
I think that sociology and sort of talking about categories of people and how they differ among, you know, like how we treat people differently is, of course, a very valuable topic and something we should talk about. I think that what is a problem in sociology sort of in general is that there's very little focus on sort of individualism. And if you think about issues such as gender, it's almost like, oh, there's men and there's women, and they have this, you know, like they have similar preferences, identities, because they are part of those categories. And so you completely neglect that, you know, there are all kinds of women, there are all kinds of men, and they don't necessarily share interests just because they're men and women. And so, you know, I think that my own take is that the better way of thinking about things is to always sort of go from the individual and say, like, that's where the rights are, that's where we should, like, it's, those are the sort of perspective we should always treat individuals well, not because they're women, not because they're gay or whatever. It's a question of like just being a good person, and individuals are worthy of respect. You know, it's kind of like sort of saying that we should of course understand that societies are not always fair in treating individuals the same, and I think that we should stand up for doing so and respecting, you know, being tolerant, being good liberals, basically. Yeah, I don't know. Something along those lines.
If there are no other questions to this talk, is it possible that we broaden the discussion to Sweden so that we can draw other people in if they haven't heard the talk? But I have a question, maybe the same or related. You talked about, you know, how a lot of liberals only talk about the markets, and that you think should it be broader, or should we actually not talk about the markets and mm-hmm. talk about something else? And are people succeeding at, you know, convincing the liberals to do that? And are they then more successful at you know, convincing other people that liberalism is, I don't know, good or desirable or something? What is your opinion on this?
Yeah. So here's my answer to that. I think that extending the discussion on markets and what markets contribute to society to also talk about things outside of efficiency, competition, wealth, growth, whatever that economists are fascinated with, to also sort of say, like, what markets also do is create a lot of choice. Markets also create individuals that are good at keeping their promises, solving problems together, collaborating to create great new things, you know, sort of like the constructive side also of market societies in social terms, you know. And we could remind ourselves from time to time there that although there are, you know, gender differences in Western societies, we're still the best we have in the world. I mean, you know, just kind of sort of living up to saying, like, there's nowhere else in the world where women and men are treated as much the same as they are in our societies. So even if it's not perfect, you know, it's not like the other systems are, you know, excelling and you know, are so wonderful either. So, you know, it's a process. It's evolutionary.
Okay, before I give the floor to other questions, I will maybe bridge it. What do you think about Hans Rosling's, you know, public books and appearances? Is he in this spirit?
Yes.
Is he a good classical liberal?
Was he? Yeah. I don't really know, but I suspect that he was a liberal. Just the way he, I mean,
not him personally, but what he talked about, how he talked about it.
Yes.
To me, I recommend him as a great libertarian author, basically.
I do too. Actually, one of my recommendations when I was talking about this previously is that we should start every lecture on any topic with a Hans Rosling video, because it puts it in perspective, right? I mean, if you start thinking about child mortality before you talk about problems of education, you get some perspective and you realize that, you know, the world isn't so shabby after all. And, you know, so it's a way of sort of promoting how much progress there have been. And I think he was fantastic at doing that. Yeah. And a Swede. No, I'm just kidding.
So questions about Sweden, the Swedish labor market, the welfare state, anything?
Why do Swedes, when they are speaking English, pronouncing their names English and not Swedish? Like Johan Norberg and not Johan Norberg, yeah, and so on.
Because we want to fit in. We're a very consensus-oriented culture. And so, you know, we want people to think that we're just like you.
And how's your name pronounced then?
In Swedish?
Yes.
Lotta Stern.
It means star, no?
No, in Swedish it's not. It's just the...
Because the German word is...
Is Stern. Yeah, I know. But it's not, no, a star in Swedish is stjärna.
We were just talking about what people said or didn't say about slavery. What I want to say is, have you ever studied how misconceptions, social misconceptions can influence... How can I say this? It can influence economy. Because, for example, I have a major in, just to give an example, I have a major in North American studies, and one famous example that we always studied is a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to one of his colleagues that was a representative in the House, talking about the problem of slavery in the U.S. And he said, We find ourselves between the need for justice and the need for preservation, and that need for preservation was because slavery was a monstrosity that defied any notion of humanity, but they still needed that because it was the basis of their society, and also especially in South America. There was a society that believed in a natural order of things, and they believed that these people were supposed to be there, which reinforced the preconception, the economic preconceptions about slavery. Do you deal with this or something like this?
Me personally, no, I do not. I'm not a student of slavery, but I think that sociologists would be very sympathetic to the idea and notion that what we believe influence what is possible to achieve, and that false notions have can have very significant social outcomes. And so that, I think, is kind of part of sociological theorizing and part of the notion that sociologists in general don't think that human beings are perfectly rational or just reason-based, but that we're actually like biased and that we make mistakes and that we believe in foolish things and so you could make a very strong sociological case and explain how those kinds of ideas get a foothold in societies, kind of thing. Was that an answer?
It was a satisfying answer.
Good. I'm doing my best.
Could you give us, like the guys we came late, some short summary on your lecture about your thoughts about liberalism and sociology, like few sentences?
Sure, I can do that. So I was trying to argue that there is no such thing as classical liberal sociology today. There was, in the beginning, when sociology came about, classical liberals who were sociologists, like Herbert Spencer and others. But it all kind of died out because, for several reasons, of course, and, you know. But one of the most important things were that sociology as a discipline became really big and grew a lot in the 60s and 70s. The 60s and 70s were a very special period in Western societies, where all of a sudden people started disliking Western societies, and it became very fashionable to be critical, to see conflicts in society, and to study things like Marx. And so, you know, that turned sociology into a study of grievances or conflicts and class and all kinds of things. And of course then, you know, you get sort of a bandwagon where most of the people drawn to the field share these ideas, etc. And so here we are. It's about time to turn things around. No, I'm just kidding.
So what about the taxes and the welfare state?
Oh, yeah, what about it? Well, I did this speak in Bratislava about the Swedish labor market, and I could do a similar speak, I think, about the Swedish welfare state, and say that you may think that the Swedish welfare state is very socialist, and it used to be up until the 1990s, because we had a financial crisis and the Swedish economy basically dived, just, you know, didn't work anymore. We did a lot of interesting new things. So we implemented voucher systems in schools. We let private providers give elderly care to oldsters. We privatized a lot of things like IT, telecom, post office, yeah, stuff like that, electricity, you know. And so today what we have is...
Not the church, no. That's still state church, no?
I'm sorry?
The church is still state church.
No, it isn't.
No.
But if you are not a member, you still have to pay a burial fee. So, you know, they get money anyway, but you are not automatically born into the Swedish church. And I think that's thanks to immigration. It became really bizarre when we had started, you know, having immigrants, and their children were born into the Swedish church, and they might come from, you know, Orthodox backgrounds or Muslim backgrounds, and, you know, all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, by the way, we're claiming your kid. It's like, welcome to Sweden. So then, you know, that was the end of the state church. But it is it's still bizarre.
But I interrupted the flow of the economic reform, sorry.
The Swedish welfare state is still big, and you know we have extremely high taxes, but Yeah, we'll see how long it lasts.
So I have a follow-up question because I'm really intrigued by the voucher system. Like, education is a hot topic in the country, and I would say that those who are in favor of very centralized education system, they would also say, like, let's take Sweden as an example. So can you elaborate about, like, the voucher system in education in Sweden?
So what happened is that it's a pseudo market or a quasi market, if you want, because still, of course, the state authorities say whether or not you can open a new school. And so, you know, you have to apply and you have to be, you know, live up to their standards and you have to do all these kinds of things. So it's not like it's a free entry. Just put up your sign and say, here's a school, come students. That's not how it works. And it is a very heavily right now criticized system because it has created great inflation. So whereas before grades were meaningful, it's very iffy today if they mean anything, which is a challenge. And so what happened was that a very, very interesting and extremely successful reform was mismanaged. So instead of like dealing with the troubles before, you know, sort of before they became acute, politicians in Sweden just sort of let it be, and now it's become very, very hostile. So yeah, it's a complicated issue today, but it has created a lot of good things. And again, like when you criticize something and say it could be better, you should also remember what it was like before the schools were private. And so we now have choice. You can choose your school. You can go to an English school. You can go to a Montessori school. You can, you know, attend all kinds of schools that suits your preferences. And before there was just one kind.
Let me share some of my thoughts on the Swedish school system. I've done a little bit of looking into this, and I did a talk about it in an article, which was, I think, Timbro's number one downloaded piece because it was so provocative to people. I think they called it, Are Your Children Being Indoctrinated? There's some structural things that are, I think, are super central and important. And one is about you can't just necessarily enter. There's some controls on entry. Another thing to keep in mind is that it's fixed price, essentially. Yeah. Just so everyone's clear on that, maybe that's what you figured. But you can't, as a private school, it's not like you can charge more than the voucher. Okay, so it's kind of like a fixed price system. But I think the two biggest problems are the teacher pipeline and teacher credential requirements, where you have to have a certain certificate from a communist teacher pipeline, where the education schools are basically all totally left wing. And they get lousy students, and they are all left-wing. And so no matter who you are, if you're required to have teachers with certificates from those programs, you have to hire leftists. Now, my understanding is that it's not like it's 100% have to have the certificate, but they do, like, demand that, and they look for that. And the more you have, the better it is in terms of their approval. So there's real pressure on that. And, you know, what is education if it's not the teacher? Like, if your teacher is a jerk or not enthusiastic or an idiot or a woke fool, it's death, right? So that's really huge. And then the other thing is the curriculum. They have this when I did that talk anyway, I don't think it's changed. They have this horrible curriculum which, like, forces environmental gibberish into every subject, not every single subject, but, like, requires all of this attention to environmental, you know, sayings and slogans to get the students to repeat this stuff. You know, if it's a chemistry course, you have to talk about, you know, how much energy is used if the bridge is built out of this material rather than that material, and so on and so forth. But I think the teacher pipeline and the credentialism, that'll kill it. I mean that really will hold it back, because the whole beauty of the idea of the open market is that all these people with enthusiasm for a subject and the ability to hold students' attentions would be available and open, and so.
I have a lot of questions about Sweden. I think we would be remiss not to talk about NATO enlargement. What is the debate, or what is the sentiment in Sweden about this? If I'm not mistaken, our army uses Swedish airplanes, jets. Is that correct? Yes. So, what's the thinking among the Swedes?
The Swedes have now decided that NATO is a good idea. And so, like in all other major questions that we face, we say like, no, 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 no. And then, yes, we think it's a good idea. But really, I think that a lot of Sweden, especially like the right-wing parties in Sweden, has been pro-joining NATO for a long time. The Social Democrats has been against joining NATO for an equally long time. And so it has been this kind of divide between the right and the left. And, you know, since the Social Democrats are often in majority, there really hasn't been much of an issue. And it has been very controversial and not very popular among Swedes, because we cherish the idea of being neutral. Like, we like to think of ourselves as, like, we're not taking sides, we're in the middle, you know, like, we're you know, we don't want to fight with anyone, and so we kind of stand outside. Although it's kind of been obvious for a very long time which side we're, you know, part of. But, you know, regardless of that, after the Russia-Ukraine war happened, the opinion shifted. And so now it's like everybody, every political party, I think, except for the left wing, perhaps. Maybe not the Enviros, I don't know. But, you know, everybody else is kind of like, okay, we're joining now. And so there you go. Very little debate, very little opposition. All of a sudden, it shifted. I can't explain it better than that. That's how I.
And what's the thinking on the Turkish opposition?
Well, of course, we think that the Turks are wrong to say that we are pro-terrorists. But if we are or not, I do not know. I don't really know enough of sort of those kinds of issues to have an informed opinion. My guess would be that there's something in between. You know, there's something to what Erdogan is arguing. It might not be much, but you know, I don't know.
Well, you stole my question. I was going to ask about the Turks as well. I guess I can kind of expand on that. You said you didn't know what the gist of the question was. But I know some things, like, for example, I know that they won't let your country join us because you're harboring critics of the PKK, also they want to lift they want you to lift some bans on Turkey, especially I think for weapons trade. I guess I could ask you, like, based on this very limited and I'm not sure credible information, do you think that concessions should be made or no?
It's not like I think Sweden should protect terrorists. So I guess it's the question for me is really like, are they actual terrorists or doesn't Erdogan just like them? I mean, it's kind of like, I don't really, that's what I mean. It's like, I don't really know. And so
the question itself, I believe, is very complex because, for example, the this, let's just call it like the Syrian chapter has helped a lot to advance, for example, U.S. interests. And so they, for some time, have been not terrorists, but somewhat allies of ours. What I also understand is that they have some extreme form of expressing their opposition to the Turkish government, especially in Turkey. They I do believe there was some years of civil war with Turkey because of they wanted their area, the Kurdish area, to be recognized independent, but they haven't got that. So until now, I haven't seen anything that has given us reason to say that they are terrorists. But then again, I'm not exactly the best source.
And that's my impression too, that the Kurdish question is sort of a sore thing, and for Erdogan and Turkey in general, and so. I don't know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so it's a very, very, very tough question. And I mean, just the amount of time it has taken, and you know, they're not getting anywhere on resolving it, the issue. So it's kind of like, who knows, who's to blame here.
I might ask a question, maybe back from Sweden to sociology, because I haven't a chance to ask a proper sociologist before. Conservative liberals, libertarians, often mention that there is such thing as a culture war. Is it a really a thing, and should it be addressed at all?
I see. Yeah. No, I think it is a real thing. I do think that the fighting that we see between ideas and especially relating to cultural notions is real, and that it is troubling. It's a real challenge to Western liberal democracy, I think, that we're starting to be very intolerant, very illiberal in our sort of just everyday exchange with one another. And so, yes, there really is an issue there that we need to address.
Unless there's somebody who really wants to ask a question into the podcast, I think I will end the official taping part with my question, and then we can have an informal debate with beers and stuff. We had this class in my university that was called Sociology for Economists. And the fun part of it was basically no sociology. It was all economics. And I remember one thesis from the first class. The teacher said, all the great sociologists were also economists. Uh-huh. What do you think about that?
That is true.
Great. Thank you.
Weber was. I guess Durkheim wasn't an economist. So.
Is he good in your?
He is very good. I think he's very good. I think he's very insightful. He might have been a conservative more than a liberal, but his stuff is worth reading. It you learned about the world.
Okay, thank you very much, and enjoy the evening.